Money is not a real resource. It is just a reflection of the goods and services in the society that uses that money. It is a network indicator for where and how resources ought to be spent. Now, Keynesians will constantly say that deflation causes problems in the economy. It leads to contractions. It leads to an economic crisis. When really, deflation itself is just the correction in the price of money related to resources. It's completely agnostic. It doesn't do anything. The question is, why did the deflation happen? And it can happen in three different ways. And it's funny, all you have to do when you realize that money itself is not the resource, that you have to be looking at the economy to see what's happening, it makes perfect sense which deflationary event is going to cause a problem and which is specifically resulting from something good. It's time for a Guy's Take episode. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin, to plug your life into a Bitcoin standard, to learn everything you need to know about it, set up an auto buy and auto withdrawal, set up your IRA, set up a business account and get your treasury on it, you name it. Check out swanbitcoin.com/guy. And the show is also brought to you by the way you're going to keep your Bitcoin safe, CoinKite and the ColdCard hardware wallet. After you buy your Bitcoin, the thing that you should do above all else is get yourself a secure hardware wallet. And you can get a discount with my code BitcoinAudible. Links and details for our sponsors will be in the show notes. So, why does modern economics get deflation so terribly wrong? I've been wanting to hit this idea for a while, and I'm probably going to do a two sats video on it as well to do my best to get this argument as succinct as I possibly can, because I think this is a really important one to hit, and it's one that's so deeply misunderstood where different types of deflation are conflated with each other. And even though we've talked a lot about these ideas in the past from kind of different contexts, and we've also talked specifically about deflation when it comes to sound money, I wanted to hit deflation in all of its forms, and why is Keynesian economics so broken in understanding what the consequence of deflation is? And even though in the two sats video that I did about the deflation boogeyman and the subsequent episode that I did alongside that, which I recommend you go check out as well, I've noticed the more and more that I think about it, what a complete dodge the whole idea of money going up in value causes people to hoard it, and this causes deflation, and this is bad for the economy, really is. Specifically because that has never been the cause of an economic problem. Ever. If you actually look at the periods of credit deflation that cause such negative effects, none of it has to do with people hoarding money because it's going up in value, like they think they're getting rich. The problems are the defaults. They're the destruction of credit instruments. They're the revoking of contracts of resources that are supposed to go somewhere that get shut down. It's the literal contraction of the economic engine, not because people aren't spending, but because we spent too much and didn't actually have any resources to fulfill the obligations. So the kind of backsplaining excuse that people are going to hoard money and never spend it and this will be detrimental to the economy is nonsense on so many different levels, because it doesn't even happen during the times in which they point to deflation occurring and saying that this is bad. That has nothing to do with the cause of credit deflation. So I wanted to hit, I think people still continuously misunderstand why deflation is a bad thing when it is a bad thing, and why deflation is a good thing when it is a natural thing. And I think the best way to understand this is to understand that there are three different kinds of deflation, or three different ways in which the general purchasing power of money can go up. And if you want to understand the effects of all three of those kinds of deflation, all you have to do is look at what is happening with the resources. Remember, money is just a reflection. It's just a record-keeping system. So all you have to actually do to understand what the consequences and where the problems arise from certain types of deflation, or from the quote-unquote purchasing power of money going up, is understanding why it is going up and what's happening specifically with its relationship to the resources in society. That is the only thing we are concerned about. And when you look at that from the three different reasons, from the three different ways that the money-resource relationship can change, it makes it perfectly clear why credit deflation is a disaster, natural deflation is perfectly fine, and there's actually a middle option, which I think is far more relevant specifically to Bitcoin, but still applies to any money, really, but where the problem is completely isolated to an individual, to the cases where that money is lost. So to start this off, let's go through the three different ways in which money goes up in purchasing power relevant to the amount of resources in the economy and why. So the first, which is what Keynesians point to all the time, is credit deflation. And this is less to do with what's happening with resources in the economy and more to do with the drastic collapse in the amount of money. Understand, if we are creating money out of thin air, if we are issuing debt from nothing, and then we are creating more obligations than we have in resources to fulfill. And this happened during, this is why they say the gold standard was, you know, during the late 1800s and early 1900s before they essentially attempted to remove the gold standard and did eventually in its totality. The reason they would claim that it was volatile and unreliable and caused a bunch of booms and busts is because we would issue more debt than we had in gold. It had nothing to do with the gold standard. It had to do with the fact that we were constantly breaking the gold standard and constantly issuing credit backed by nothing at all. And individual banks would do this, as well as the banking system as a whole, and the government would do this. So it's literally like they rented out five houses as Airbnbs, and then five people showed up to rent or to use those Airbnbs for the same weekend, and it turned out they only had three houses. And then they're like, this stupid system is too volatile. It's just always canceling plans. It's like, well, no shit, dummy. You are the problem. And the Great Depression, and well, at least what led to the Great Depression, and then the government-caused Great Depression that resulted from the collapse, is a perfect example, because if you look at debt levels actually soared to, I think it was 350-ish, 400% of GDP, of the actual productivity of the country, which GDP is not a very good measure, but we're going to use it just for the sake of comparison, because what we want to know is the relationship then versus the relationship now and how it differs or how it is similar. But it was well over 300% of GDP, and this grew from about 100% to that number, which the only really sustainable metric is 100%. If you have a certain amount of productivity and you have a certain amount of debt, the debt should never surpass the productivity, or you are in a downward spiral, or you are simply going to continue to expand, and you've basically just over-leveraged. You have promised resources that don't exist and that you cannot create. This is why, if you look historically, it actually does fluctuate a little bit above and a little bit below 100 pretty consistently until we lost the gold standard. And after the creation of the Federal Reserve, what we saw was a sharp and quick growth in the amount of debt, because that kind of pressure, the ability to defraud the system and expand debt aggressively, was suddenly let loose. A major restriction on that avenue was suddenly made available and made easily accessible to the Federal Reserve, to the newly created Federal Reserve System and the fractional reserve banking system. So they created enormous amounts of debt. Then after that crash and the subsequent reconsolidation, what happened is they got better at simply managing the speed to which they increased the debt. But it only caused a bigger problem over a longer time period. If you look at the total debt to GDP ratio, you'll notice that it spikes aggressively in the 1920s, and then collapses in 1929. And then as we get into the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, what you see is that same growth occurring, but much more gradually, much more slowly, much more controlled, with, you know, returns, slow returns to the mean, and then continued growth, etc., until we kind of get into the 2010s and 2020s, where it started exploding again. And now we are actually far worse than we were before the Great Depression. But we don't really have any way to pull the plug on this disaster. We don't have the liquidity to actually exit. We still had a pseudo-gold standard in the late 1920s and 1930s, and enough of the economy was still based on actual agreements and actual attempts to, you know, withdraw from the banks and actual gold in people's possession, that there was enough liquidity to actually cause the collapse. Now, we have nothing. We have just quantitative easing. We just have constantly papering over. Everything is digital. The withdrawals are digital. Everything is fake. It's paper money all the way down. From top to bottom, it is credit. There is no real money anymore. And because of that, there is no exit. In fact, Bitcoin is the only exit. It simply doesn't have the liquidity to essentially call the bluff of this disastrous situation. But a credit crisis will result in deflation. This is what the Keynesians point to. So the question is, why does it result in deflation? And what is actually going on in the economy? Why is it such a disaster? Again, look at what happens with the money versus the resources. If you are 300% in debt against your 100% amount of resources in the economy and productivity that you actually have available to you, if you are scheduled to use, that's what this means. That's what it means to have a credit of this level, of this amount, is that you are scheduled to need 3 times the amount of resources that are actually available for use. What happens when you get to a point where you find out that you aren't going to be able to get all of the resources that you need to complete your credit-based project? You default. You cannot fulfill the debt because the debt has been issued against resources that do not exist, and it becomes a competition to see who can actually survive, because necessarily 2 out of 3 projects are going to go up in flames. So then this means that the economy is a disaster. This means that economic productivity is falling. Why would there be deflation? Well, how was the money created in the first place? By issuing the debt out of thin air. The debt is the money. So when you default on that debt, money is being deleted from the system. Think about it. If there's $100 million of just base money floating around, and then you issue $200 million worth of debt, well, that means there is $300 million of actual currency units floating around the society. But when those debts are defaulted on, the money literally vanishes. The $10,000 in debt that I have literally poofs. It disappears. And suddenly there's a massive collapse in the money supply back down to maybe $100 million worth, or at least whatever is not sustainable and that the economy can't actually make up for, the resources that can't be expended to keep those projects alive. So this causes deflation because the resources, the amount of resources we have, do not go up, and in fact, they collapse because a lot of people who are in productive endeavors have to shut down their productive endeavors. But more importantly, an enormous amount of money that is chasing those resources vanishes into thin air. So between, let's say resources is one unit and money is one unit. They're the same. We have balance between the money and the resources, and there is some set price. Well, then if we tripled the amount of money in the economy with the same one unit of resources, well, then every unit of resource is going to be $3. It's going to be 3 units of money. Now, if you delete 2/3 of that money supply, you're going to have a whole lot of agreements and a whole lot of contracts that have been made under the assumption that a unit of goods, a unit of resources, is going to cost 3 units of money. But now 2/3 of the money vanishes again, and we go back to a one-to-one ratio between resources and money. And now all of those contracts now have a disastrous scenario on their hands because they are contracted. They're setting up arrangements and they made plans based on a relationship between resources and money that isn't even remotely relevant anymore. And so more contracts get canceled. More defaults happen, more debt or more money gets deleted from the system, and the cycle continues until all of the bad debt is cleared out. And this causes a collapse in economic productivity and consumer spending and all of those things that Keynesians say we need to prop up the economy, to have a healthy economy. But why did those things disappear? Is it really because a whole bunch of people are now hoarding the money because they're trying to get rich? Is that the big change that happened? Everybody's now grasping onto the money as tightly as they can because they think this money's going to go up in value forever and they'll just never have to consume anything and they'll just be rich. Is that the problem? Is that what has suddenly conjured into the minds of all of the people, and they've all drastically changed their behavior because they all just want to get rich hoarding money? Of course not. What does that have? None of that exists. You know what's happening? Everybody is scared to death of being able to make any sort of contract because nobody knows how many resources there are because our money has been lying to us. So they grasp onto the money and they refuse to spend and they refuse to engage in economic activity because they were just defrauded for 10 years and now there's a collapse. It has exactly all to do with people hoarding money to get rich. Honestly, the more I think about it, I cannot understand where in the hell that idea even came from. It's so stupid. It's never happened. It has nothing to do with what is going on in credit crises. It's a breakdown of trust. It's a breakdown of people. It's people having no clue what is actually going to happen in the economy because none of the contracts and none of the prices are accurate anymore. They're thrown into total chaos because the very system we use to keep track of resources and understand what the value and scarcity of those resources are has been defrauded. And now it needs to fluctuate wildly and try to find some sort of equilibrium as supplies of all of these things are being deleted and created at so many different billions of different interactions and at different places in the economy, both globally and locally. And so nobody has any idea. Everybody's uncertain of everything. And so what do? You run to the money. That is literally the purpose of money. It is a hedge against uncertainty. You hoard gold, you hoard cash, you hoard bullets, you hoard anything that actually has some degree of assurance as to what its value and what its use is going to be in the future, because everything else is chaos, and it's specifically chaos because of the fraud committed by the fiat system being unraveled. the reason people hoard money during a credit crisis is because of the chaos that is unleashed in the markets when tons of contracts are constantly being canceled and no one has any idea how many resources actually exist to be used. It has nothing to do with people hoarding money trying to get rich because it's worth more every year. Now, a lot of times people will bring up another scenario that is very relevant to Bitcoin, is the deletion of money through the loss of keys, because you can actually literally delete Bitcoin out of existence. Doesn't this then cause a credit crisis? Doesn't this then cause a collapse in the money supply and subsequent chaos in the markets, just like in a credit crisis? No, it doesn't. And all you have to do, yet again, is understand what's happening to the actual resources. So the important reason why a credit crisis is such a disaster, why someone defaulting on their loan is destructive to the economy, is because of, again, what happened to the resources. Let's break it down between just you and me. Just do two people and go into the idea of the debt and then the resources. What is occurring? So first, let's look at the state of the resources in a simple borrow and lend situation. We'll take money out of the equation just to kind of simplify the image in our head. I have 100,000 logs, right? I have wood that can be used for any generic purpose. And rather than having a purpose myself that I want to do with it, like this is the whole purpose of lending, right? Is I have funds or I have resources and I don't really have a good use for them. So what I am going to do is I'm going to loan them out with a percentage return, right? I'm going to loan you all of that lumber so that you can do something with it because you believe you have a productive endeavor, and then you are going to pay me back 10% every single year on that lumber to essentially pay me for borrowing. You're renting the resources. You're generically renting resources from me and paying me a rental fee in order to use those resources up for your goals, even though they belong to me and I own them. So then you engage in some project, you cut all the lumber up, you make boards out of it, and you start to create some building or some enterprise or machines or whatever it is. You start into some project. But then halfway through, you realize that it's not going to work, prices have shifted, something has gone wrong, and you have to quote-unquote default on your loan. You now cannot pay me back those resources. And you may have made a contract for resources that you are going to create from that machine or from that building or enterprises with someone else. So when that contract goes up in smoke, I am suddenly out all of that lumber. And instead of having resources to do something useful that I could have done with them originally, I now have to attempt to claw back whatever amalgamation, whatever disaster thing that you have created, and rip it apart and see what 10, 20% of value I can get out of it while I take a massive loss on my original savings. So to frame it very simply, what occurred? The debt allowed you to consume the resources first, and then you were going to recreate them plus an additional value to replenish those resources back into society. And think about this. When we're going back to the picture of the entire society and the entire economy, we're talking about all this fractional reserve and this constant issuance of debt. We're talking about paying for food, for laborers, hours of time, for trying to start into some sort of a project. We're talking about the insane level of consumption of resources, most of which cannot be recovered. There's an enormous amount of consumption that is just ongoing. Like a sandwich doesn't last. Houses fall apart. Cars fall apart. If somebody uses that for 5 years, it's not worth the same. It's not the same resource as when it was brand new. literally everything rots. There are actually only a few things that do not break down quickly. Most things do. They don't last very long, and they're not even close to worth the same as a used item as they are a new product. And the liquidity and the ability to actually get value out of them, if they are used, if they are degraded, if they are rotted, if they are poorly maintained, if the fuel is used up, whatever it is incredibly small. It's way less than their value as new available resources. So what a debt does is let more people consume the resources, use up the resources and the capital of society, than can sustainably be served by the resources and capital that we actually have. And then when they default on the loan, it's a recognition in the market that they used up all of those resources and they aren't going to put them back in. And tons of people base their retirements, based next year's plans, based business contracts, based reasons for going into business in the first place, went into certain industries, chose a certain life profession, made certain decisions about whether to start a family or go into their career based off of false price signals, based off an illusion of what the future of the market held and what the market could actually sustain that wasn't true. And when it becomes true again, when it floods back into the market and it tries to punch the market in the face to bring everybody back to reality, all of those lifetimes worth of decisions, worth of agreements, worth of choices get undone. Smart choices suddenly become dumb choices. Good careers suddenly become terrible wastes of time and resources. Growing industries become dying industries. This is why everyone hoards money, because no one knows what's going to happen. Nobody trusts to make long-term agreements with anyone because all of their previous long-term agreements just got rug pulled. So, why is this not the case with Bitcoin when you delete Bitcoin from society? Because you're still doing the same thing, right? Like the loss of credit, the default of the credit is the deletion of money in the economy. So if you delete a bunch of Bitcoin, shouldn't that do the exact same thing? Well, no, of course not. And all you have to do is look at what happened with the resources. To save Bitcoin, to save a sound money that can't be issued out of thin air, is to literally create resources and not consume any. Going back to the example I always use of Michael, the guy who makes sandwiches for everybody. He makes 1 million sandwiches and he saves $1 million. If he accidentally sets that $1 million in cash on fire, it does nothing to the economy. It doesn't hurt anybody else. It hurts him. Because what he was holding on to was, in a sense, a debt of society's back to him. It's a record-keeping system of all of the things that we owe him back that he has done for society. So his deletion, his burning of all of that cash, actually lowers the price, increases the value of all of the other money in the system, because the resources have stayed the same, and in fact, all of the resources that he put into society that he had earned the right to take back out, we can no longer verify. We no longer have any way to know that he has actually owed those resources and that we can actually trade those resources and continue the operation of that record-keeping system. So he simply loses his right to them. He loses his ability to redeem all of those things he did for society. So society gets to keep them. So in the situation of the debt, let's say Michael went $100,000 into debt to make a bunch of sandwiches and then fails to do so and can't pay it back. Well, then he used up a whole bunch of resources and can't pay it back, and now he has to default, and the money is deleted from society after all of the resources were already used up. So now he is not going to put back the resources. He took a ton of resources out, and now he's not going to put them back. When you delete cash, when you delete or destroy the monetary asset itself that you have saved, it means that you have put resources into the economy, and you're not going to take them back out. They are the exact opposite. The deletion of money during a credit crisis is the exact opposite of the deletion of saved money. When you delete your cash, when you delete your Bitcoin keys, it's essentially a donation to everything to everyone else in society. It is saying that all the resources that society was going to pay you back, if you did that on purpose, it's basically you saying, okay, don't worry about it, just keep it all. It's now a donation. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin, to get Bitcoin in your IRA, to set up an IRA in just a few minutes. If you want to secure your Bitcoin in a vault with an institution that is helping to manage those keys and can actually be there in the case of a disaster to help you recover so you don't end up one of those people who has actually accidentally deleted their keys and deleted their Bitcoin from existence, that's what the vault is for. It's so that Swan Bitcoin can help you recover by holding one of your keys in a multi-sig setup. Then they have Swan Private for high net worth individuals. They are an incredible resource for figuring out what to do with your Bitcoin, what Bitcoin is, how to understand it, and how to position yourself for the long term. And the age-old, the best thing is the automatic buy and withdraw. The ability to buy Bitcoin, which I have been doing for a long time, to buy Bitcoin every single week and automatically have it withdraw to my keys, to my cold storage. There is no better way to stack. You can find all of this plus an entire suite of financial services for Bitcoin to get on a Bitcoin standard or just get started. And for the next $10,000, or for your first $10,000, there are no fees at all for buying Bitcoin. Check them out. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. The link and details are right in the show notes. And then that leads us to our third reason for deflation. So there is delete money through credit default, delete money as savings, delete the actual monetary unit or the monetary goods itself. This would be the equivalent of also somehow destroying the gold, which you just melt gold. So, I mean, I guess you could like irradiate it until it turns into lead or something like that. Or actually, I think lead has, I think that would be adding a neutron, not taking away. I don't remember where it is on the periodic table. But regardless, gold is really hard to destroy. But you could put enough energy into it to turn it into a different element if you really wanted to. And so I guess it would be the better example would be the equivalent of, you know, gold dropped to the bottom of the ocean in a treasure chest, you know, a pirate booty, or sent off into the sun and never to be seen again. Those things are purely bad for the economy of its owner. The only person who loses in that scenario is the one who owned the money that got destroyed. In the credit crisis, in the credit default scenario, the person who loses is the person who owned the resources that were used up by the debtor who cannot return the resources. And then there is sound money, natural deflation. When the amount of productivity, the amount of capital, the amount of goods and services in society go up, while the money stays the same. So why isn't this bad for society? Because it's literally just letting us know how much more prosperous society is. That is literally what it is. The natural deflation of money, the natural growth in the purchasing power of money, is the literal measure of increased societal prosperity. That is exactly what it measures. And what this does is naturally reward people for not consuming the resources that we need to increase productivity, to innovate, to engage in productive endeavors in the first place. It's basically replacing mindless consumption with productive consumption. And so the regular increase, the natural increase in the price of money, all it does is disincentivize useless, destructive consumption. This is why consumer credit cards literally didn't exist. The idea of going into debt to just buy and destroy stuff, to just go eat food or buy a TV and watch it fall apart or become useless, to go have a night on the town, to just mindlessly use up resources. I mean, think about it. If we were actually treating resources with their actual value and their actual cost, would you Would you lend resources to people to go do that? Like, let's say you've got a car, and sometimes you need your car, but sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't use it for a week. You've got an extra one, right? You have a second car. And so you rent it to somebody else, and they just set it on fire. They just destroy it. But they say they're going to pay you back. They don't have any productive use of it. They're not using it to, they're not starting a business. They're just going to use it up, and they say they'll give it back to you. Would you rent it to them? Would you loan those resources out knowing that that's actually what's being done? That they have no intent to have some sort of a productive use of those resources? This is exactly why consumer credit was virtually not a thing, or was so rare as to be not known in just the common, Overton window of the average person, of the average life. If you wanted something, you just saved up for it. Scarce resources were treated like scarce resources. The gradual increase, and I talk about this in Fiat Waste, but the gradual increase in the value of money over time because of the growth and increased prosperity of society. It is one of the most crucial forces for the preservation of our goods and the capital in society as exists. Like, there's almost no other force that is as important as the money's reflection, the money's recognition or telling us of the value of not consuming those resources today. And what's funny is it actually behaves as one of the most important and only really good passive investments. Think about it. If you want a passive investment, there's really just not much available to you. You can keep money or cash in a mattress, or you can buy some sort of an asset and just hope it goes up in value or in price. Now, there's a bunch of different assets that you can buy. You can buy a stock, like an index fund. This is what basically has become the dominant thing. But what actually happens is that you're not actually buying the stock or the index fund in any sort of an active manner, and you have a massive counterparty risk. You now are dependent on someone else specifically in order for the value of that to go up, in order to make any sort of a return. And you could just as easily lose money as you could gain money in investing. In fact, you could far more likely to lose money, especially in a sound money environment, by just kind of picking a stock and putting money in it. So what happens is you go to an index, which now means you have a financial middleman. You have someone taking fees and managing what should be in the index. How much should the allocation be? You go to a financial planner and a financial manager, and now you have the financial system, some institution or some broker trying to decide how to use your funds. And you have you have a principal agent problem now introduced into the equation. Because what you want is for someone to be as active as possible, trying to do everything they can to make as much money for you as they possibly can. Whereas their success and their incentive is to do as little work as possible to keep getting your commission or the percentage of whatever it is, the fee that comes with the management of your funds. Or, of course, the percentage that comes with trading. This is why crypto exchanges are constantly trying to push new crap on you, because they only make money if you trade. Not if you actually get a return and actually increase value on your Bitcoin holdings. They want you to sell your Bitcoin and buy Solana, and then they want you to sell your Solana and buy Ethereum, and then they want you to sell your Ethereum and buy Dogecoin. They make money off of your instability in your investment. They want you all over the place. They do not care whether you make money. In fact, if something goes down, that's good for them, because you are going to sell it and buy something else. And this is essentially the problem with all quote-unquote passive investments, is that investments need active investors. And in fact, you don't want to waste resources toward passive investments, because it specifically means that money is going toward investments that wouldn't be made if it were actually handed to an active investor, if someone was actually making intelligent, thorough, extremely well thought out decisions about what to invest in. This is why passive investments are largely just inflation hedges. They only exist, it bloats the financial markets and causes so many secondary and tertiary negative effects, while exploding the amount of capital that is actually available to massive corporations and a bunch of financial institutions who don't have any more ideas on what to invest in. It's not as if just because you put more money somewhere that means that all of the ideas are better, or that all of the ways that that money could be productively used suddenly just multiply tenfold. To the contrary, you just have too much capital, and even good ideas at the right amount of capital might be ruined by having too much. Think about it, there might be a business idea that's actually perfect for the $100,000, $200,000 range, but that at $5 million is just a waste of resources. When the price of capital is obscured by the fiat system, all of the ability to actually make the intelligent economic calculation for investments like that falls away, and it completely props up an absurd passive investment ecosystem and industry that largely makes no sense at all and has tons of counterparty risk and a massive friction of fees and control and management from an industry. It makes zero sense whatsoever that there is any return on passive investments like a generic stock market index. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole just because we already did this in the fiat finance episode, which was a couple of guys' takes back. So I will have the link to that one in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it, I highly recommend it. It's about the many second and third order effects of the consequences of what the fiat system and the constant printing and inflation of money does to the financial industry, and subsequently to the capital available to the rest of the economy at the same time. Because remember, there's no such thing as quote-unquote not investing. It's always a decision of what to invest in. If you are saving, you are investing in yourself or your family's future and stability. If you are putting it in the stock market, you're investing in some giant corporate enterprise, and you're paying fees to some financial middleman. So check that out if you haven't, because there's a lot to unpack there. But going back to natural deflation, what it means to just park money under your mattress or invest in gold or invest in Bitcoin into a sound monetary good that will slowly go up in value, it is literally the only real passive investment. And what you are actually doing is investing in an index fund for the entire society. That's essentially what money is. Money is a reflection of all of the goods and services and innovations and everything that is available, the capital that is put to use for the benefit of society. Money is its reflection. So if you are saving money and you're expecting it to slowly go up in value over time, what you are doing is taking a no counterparty, least possible risky investment in the future of the society itself. And one of the results of that investment in quote-unquote the society, in the money itself, is that you're leaving those resources for other people. When you are taking out a stock or taking ownership in a company or taking out a house or real estate or anything or a collectible, anything else that you are doing as an asset that you want to hold in order to get value over time, in order for it to increase in price, if you are holding it specifically for that rather than its utility, you are literally taking those resources out of society to not use it for its utility when someone else does need it for its utility. Whereas money is the one thing that doesn't have utility. It does not have some alternative use case. Its entire purpose is as a record-keeping system to be exchanged for today and exchanged back for goods at some point in the future. Taking money out of circulation does nothing. It takes nothing from no one. It is the act. It is the literal flip side of the coin of giving resources to people and not taking them away. And when it comes to its results on society, what its consequences are, is it creates consumers in the future. It leaves those resources and those capital goods available to produce more and to be more productive, and it is a signal to those producers to produce specifically because there are people with savings who will be available to consume in a sustainable fashion. They will be able to buy stuff in the future, and what they need to do is figure out what those savers want that is more valuable than the money, that will better their lives so much, that will improve their conditions enough to get them to let go of their savings. And their savings is proof that what they are doing makes sense. It is sustainable. They can actually, those consumers are real. It's not a lie. It's not a trick. Nobody has defrauded the amount of consumption we have available to us or that is even possible. Savings is the true signal for what we are able to consume without destroying, without cannibalizing society. And this is exactly why it's so funny that it's one of those things that Keynesianism just gets everything so unbelievably backwards. It's exactly like looking at someone who, you know, has the correct, let's say there's somebody with a poverty mindset and there's somebody with a wealth mindset, and somebody who's in the wealth mindset, they're very intelligent and they're very capable, they are responsible, et cetera, et cetera. They go through their life, let's say this is back when a college degree was actually a half-decent investment. They get a college degree, they buy a house that's, you know, looks nice, they get a white picket fence, etc. Everything looks good. These are the results of that person's mindset and that person's actions and decisions throughout their life to be a productive member of society. Now, the Keynesian looks at this from a purely statistical point of view, and rather than deducing how it is that this person was able to create this much value and then have it, instead what they do is they make a connection between having a white picket fence and a house and being wealthy and being a productive member of society. And so what they do is they steal from all of these other people, or they just inflate, same thing. They inflate the money supply, they defraud the record-keeping system, and buy the person with the poor mindset and who is making bad decisions in their life and has not built any capital. They get them a white picket fence in their house, and then they say, look, we have twice the amount of white picket fences and twice the amount of houses. Thus, the economy is twice as prosperous, and we have twice as many healthy, productive individuals of society. Then, the poverty mindset person's house rots. They never cut their front lawn, and trees grow up and start breaking through the white picket fence. And it's all rotten. It's never cleaned. This paint starts coming off. There's a leak in the room, and it just rots out the bathroom floor, and they don't even bother to fix it. They just close the door and leave it. They're constantly drugged out, and they just have a bunch of people coming in. They bring crime to the neighborhood. It virtually becomes a homeless shelter. And after just a couple of years, the person with the poverty mindset is in exactly the same position as they were, while the person with the wealth mindset is still wealthy and productive, except for the immense drag on their resources that was the inflation and or the taxes that led to this reallocation of their productive work and their productive wealth to destructive ends. And the economic signals probably encouraged that guy to go into debt when he would not have otherwise done it because it appeared to be a smart financial decision. And now he's in an economy that's starting to fall apart and where the value of investments and contracts are plummeting because part of those contracts were tied to the poverty mindset guy's rotten house. Now suddenly he's having to dig himself out of a hole with due to decisions that he would never have made in the first place. I went way too far with that analogy, but but this is essentially what Keynesians do. They look at a healthy economy. They look at a prosperous, capital productive society. And they say, look, there's a lot of consumer spending. Look, there's a lot of people with college degrees. There's a lot of people who own houses. So then they just start chasing these statistics arbitrarily. They just say, okay, well, we'll just print a lot of money and get a bunch of people some houses. We'll print a lot of money or lower the interest rates and just get a whole bunch of people to buy stuff. We'll just increase consumer spending, and that will be good for the economy. When the consumer spending is a result, it's a result of running a surplus constantly and having saved up resources and wealth to allocate in the future. If you send everybody into debt and do so specifically like our poor bastard who had the wealth mindset and was actually making good decisions, if you send them into debt that they should not have done to begin with, all you do is rob them of their future consumption. All you do is steal it from next year. That consumption doesn't drive the economy. It's literally the destruction of resources. The only reason a wealthy society has a lot of consumption is because we made so much stuff that's available to consume. It's because we had savings. It's because people felt like they had disposable income. Their situations were secure. They're getting wealthier. They're getting more secure in their position. They feel that their career is in the right place. They have savings so that if they've made the wrong decision or if their job isn't satisfying them anymore, they can take a few months to go find a better one to improve their condition, which leads to aggressive competition in the labor markets, which leads to job conditions getting better. Because if you weren't getting air conditioning and you have 5 months worth of savings, you know what you're going to do? You're going to quit the job that doesn't give you air conditioning and you're going to go find one that does. Consumer spending doesn't cause economic growth, for Christ's sake. It is the result of a growing and prosperous economy. And ironically, one of the reasons why people feel that they can actually continue to spend out of their savings and not put themselves in a worse position is because their savings slowly goes up in value over time. It's specifically referred to as the wealth effect. As things drop in price, they appear more affordable by the same standards of how much you want saved. Like, let's say the typical person, you know, feels secure at 2 months income buffer that, you know, they've got $20,000 saved up and they want to buy a car and the car is $10,000. Well, that's too much of a hit to their savings. They're going to feel unstable in their financial situation if they use half of their savings in order to purchase that car. Now, however, 2 years down the road, let's say for some reason their situation hasn't changed at all and they've just barely been able to get by, but they're having a car now is going to greatly improve their situation. And the car is only $5,000 because of the increased productivity, because of a better option on the market, because of the growth in the economy, whatever it is. Well, now suddenly they might actually make that choice. They might actually consume and go buy that car specifically because it is no longer as big of a hit to their situation. And it makes perfect sense why the economy would be signaling this. It's now cheaper to get that car, and it now actually does. It actually does align with their decision to get a new car, because the economy is literally signaling to him that those resources aren't as scarce anymore. That those resources that are very beneficial to him and his individual situation aren't as needed in the rest of the economy. The whole society is signaling that because he waited to consume that car, which does benefit his situation, it's now half of the burden to consume that as it used to be from the economy that was 2 years ago. And for whatever reason, this could literally be because his city or all major cities now have some super advanced, completely different transportation methodology. They could just be a whole bunch of tunnels underneath the city and everybody's moving around in some other way, and so cars are now just abundant. Whatever it was, doesn't matter. It's just signaling to the economy, or it's signaling to him that using up that car now is half the burden on the economy as it was previously. So, there are three ways that deflation is created. The deletion of the money supply through credit default. The deletion and the lowering of the money supply through destruction of cash or lost Bitcoin keys or sending gold into the sun. And then there is natural deflation where the money stays scarce and the amount of resources and capital in society grows. These are three distinct mechanisms for deflation, and deflation itself is not bad. In fact, even in the credit crisis scenario, deflation is the correction of the market imbalance, the thing that was causing the problems to begin with. And the way to understand, the easy way to picture and understand why each one is either destructive or beneficial is to just look at what happens to the resources. When someone goes into debt and consumes a whole bunch of resources that other people need, consumes and uses up a house or food or hours or labor, whatever it is, that other people needed in the economy, and then doesn't pay it back, that means that the resources have been destroyed and the obligation to return those resources has been reneged on. They have said, I can no longer do this. In the scenario of deleting Bitcoin keys or sending gold into the sun or setting cash on fire, what has happened is somebody has created resources and put them into the economy, and the record that was going to allow them to take those resources back out has been destroyed. So for that individual, it is a terrible event. It is that person's earned right to use up resources that has been destroyed, whereas the society, the rest of the economy, got a surplus of resources that they now no longer have to pay back. And then the third, natural deflation, because the money is sound, is simply a result of the economy growing and becoming more productive. That's it. It doesn't go up in value otherwise. Natural deflation isn't bad for the economy because natural deflation is simply showing us it's simply the result of the economy getting better. And the line that we can't have deflation because people will hoard money expecting it to go up in value, and they want to get rich off of the money, and there will be no consumption, and nobody will ever use it for anything, and there will be a death spiral in the economy, and there will be a recession and a depression, literally applies to none of it. None of it. Not the credit problem, not the deflating and deleting of the money, and not the natural deflation. It is total made-up pseudoscience nonsense. So hopefully that makes a little bit more sense as to where deflation occurs, why it occurs, and why Keynesians stupidly equate the problems that they cause from their monetary meddling with the very thing that is the solution. And I guess it would also be pretty convenient for it always to be somebody else's fault and not their own. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to check out the other episodes that I mentioned if you haven't gone down the fiat ways to fiat finance rabbit hole. I think there's a lot to unpack that was related to this that is, it's good to get a much broader picture of what's going on. And a shout out to CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet for keeping my Bitcoin safe, and a Swan Bitcoin for supporting this show. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. It doesn't matter how smart you are unless you stop and think. Thomas Sowell.